get started. We are being recorded. And here we go. This is our Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, and we're glad to have those of you that are here, and I'm sure we'll have some people wander in. Just a couple words of introduction before I introduce the speaker. I'm Bonnie Rennie. I'm the current chair of the Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, California Council of the Blind. And just a reminder that this will be archived eventually on the convention on the website. And if you're not familiar, probably this group is familiar with ccbnet.org. And now you can go to a /convention archives link and scroll around and hear past convention programs, including our Seniors with Vision Loss ones. And I'm going to put in a shameless plug, and I'll probably do it at the end when hopefully other people have come in. We are looking for volunteers to either join the Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, be a part of the committee, be on the conference calls, help do tasks, help plan convention programs, all that. Or if you really feel like you are not up to being on the committee, but you are interested in seniors' issues and you do have a little time to donate to projects, I'm expecting that you will be hearing in your chapters a letter from me through Donna Pomerantz to let you know some of the specific kinds of help we need. Because frankly, we can't have programs, we can't do anything other than programs if we don't have people to do the work. So please do not only think about that yourselves, but pass it on to other people you know in your chapters or your affiliate. And we really do need some more help. We have a small committee, and we're not looking for just people, obviously, to occupy seats, but to help us with projects. And that may be something that you feel needs addressing, and we haven't addressed it yet. Before I introduce our first speaker, and as you know, we're going to have two wonderful speakers from really excellent resources today. I do plan to follow this up with an article if you have trouble getting down phone numbers or things that you will see later. And of course, you can call the office if you miss something. They'll probably refer you to me, Bonnie Rennie. That's cool. But this is information people in your chapter need as well as you might want to know. And I'm going to come back to that at the end. First, I'd like to see who is here with us. And there's only one microphone, unfortunately. There's a shortage of them. Yeah, okay. And what we will do, people get frustrated about this. I know they don't always hear. We will, and I'm sure Patrick and Amy later on will be willing to repeat questions on the mic. So that everyone hopefully can hear, and it will be recorded. So if that's okay, who do we have with us in the room? No one knows where to start, huh? Let's start in the back.
Okay, I'll try it. Okay. I'm Joe Smith. I'm Department of Rehabilitation, part-time, and it's good to be here.
Oh, and it's always good to be here. And it's always good to have Joe. It's, of course, good to have everyone, but it's really good to have Joe because he's a man of, well, there's a slogan for you. He's a man of power and influence, as are we all in our own particular sphere.
Nobody else on this side, so go
okay.
On your side, Josie.
Me?
Go ahead.
Charlotte, good. All right, Charlotte is a committee member. Yay. Good.
I'm Roland Wong, first time from San Francisco.
Wonderful, Roland. Glad to have you.
Okay, Diane Phelps from Solano County.
Oh, good.
Josie Conkey from the Capital Chapter in Sacramento, retired from Society for the Blind on Top Rail.
Great.
I'm retired now, and I got to get busy.
Well, good. We know a couple of places for you, too.
Okay. Already.
I'm Martin Jones.
Oh, glad to have you with us as well.
All right.
Good.
I'm Susan Hyatt from San Jose.
Excellent.
I'm Bob Rennie from Orange County.
My husband, thank you.
I'm Lori Kastner from Bayview Chapter.
Oh, good, Lori.
I'm Mike Kastner from Bayview Chapter.
Great.
Charlotte's Chapter.
All right. Then it's a good chapter. Well, good, and we'll hope we'll have other people come in. Glad all of you are here. I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Patrick Arbor, and I will let him mostly tell about himself. He is with the Institute on Aging in San Francisco, and I understand that you are the founder of the Friendship Line. Is that correct?
Correct.
Excellent. And once you hear about the Friendship Line, you are going to say, wow, that Patrick Arbor, he is one cool man who has really done something here. So without any more to say, here is Patrick.
And I want to thank Bonnie for inviting me to be here for this portion of your very intensive conference. You know, just seeing all the activity out there is always very wonderful. I really value and appreciate energy that people take the time out of their lives to participate in conferences. As Bonnie is saying, I have a very profound admiration for volunteers. I think it's so much in my world in terms of working in the field of mental health wouldn't happen without volunteers. When you work for a nonprofit, you really need the backing of volunteers. And I'll say more about that as we go along. As Bonnie said, my name is Dr. Patrick Arbor, and I am the founder and director of the Friendship Line program. Our formal title is the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention and Grief-Related Services. And what I know that people often, you know, are like, oh, that word suicide is so strong. But one of the things we have to face, you know, and in this world, sadly and unfortunately, is that older people have the highest rate of suicide of any age population. And we have to somehow ponder that a little bit. And my program is the only one of its kind nationwide that is wanting to help people avoid that kind of crisis that has to do with, do I live my life to its appointed end, or do I prematurely end it? And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But what we're known in the community is as Friendship Line, because that's our 24-hour telephone service. And what we're probably, what we actually do is that we try to help improve people's quality of life. As I was saying to my new best friends in the back of the room, Josie and Diane, that it's really about, as we age, as everybody in this room knows, I was saying to Josie and Diane and Bonnie that I'm 64, I'll be 65 in December. And, you know, probably for the last, well, I've worked in the field of aging since 1973, and that's when our program began. So I'm kind of aging in place as a professional, working with older adults. And so what I've seen in my own life, but I also have certainly learned from my elders. Come on in. I'm just going to pause for 1 second until. Oh, come on in. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, yeah. Come on up. No, no, no. That's great. Sure. We have plenty of room. Good morning, Barbara. Thank you. And Barbara, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, are you talking to Barbara Prime?
Yeah. Yeah, we had introduced ourselves earlier, and I just wonder if you both want to introduce yourselves.
Barbara, do you want to say your name?
Yeah, Barbara Cron from Windsor. They just let me out of the home to come down here. Been in one great month now. And my friend Jan Matthews from East Bay.
Okay, and I'm Jane Cardis from Ukiah.
And Jane is a former
Seniors and Musician Law Committee chairperson as well as a current member.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Thank you. And my name is Dr. Patrick Arbour, and I'm just talking about a program that I originated in 1973 that can be a resource for older people. And as I go along, if you have a question, please just raise your hand, and we can integrate the questions as we go along. And then, as Bonnie suggested, I'll repeat the question so that we all hear it using the microphone. One of the important opportunities that I felt back in 1973 for older adults was to have a place where they could speak confidentially about some of the concerns or issues or thoughts or joys that have affected them as we age, and particularly around meaning. And that's what Josie and Diane were talking about a little bit, is that, you know, can I verbalize, can I have a conversation about what it's like to be 75 or what it's like to be 85, what it's like to be growing older in a society such as we have here in the U.S. That isn't exactly supportive of aging. You know, ageism, like sexism, like racism, like homophobia, is very much in our lives. And then when you add to that any kind of disability, you know, in this case it may be, you know, certainly low vision or poor vision, but it might also be things like diabetes. You know, that's something that I was diagnosed with in September, and that came as a tremendous shock to me. And, you know, and it complicates, you know, the aging process. You know, and what distinguishes us from younger people is that younger people obviously feel depressed, they have problems, that sort of thing. But what they don't have to deal is with the oppression of an ageist society. Whereas for all of us, when we go to the doctor or we have problems, there's also this underlying bias that is negatively directed to older adults, and it creates an additional burden for us. And so part of my decision in terms of creating this opportunity to have a friendship line is to provide just another option. You know, there are probably other options, you know, but to add to a menu of options our 24-hour friendship line, which is a confidential line where people can call, certainly if they just want to talk, from 8 in the morning till 11 at night. And then from 11 at night till 8 in the morning, we reserve that for people who may be in a crisis, so that there's no, you know, obstacle for them to get through. And what I believe in my heart and my soul is that a lot of suffering can be mitigated, can be diminished, if people had someone to talk to. And that's why I'm always heartened when I go to conferences to see so many people, whether they're in volunteer roles or leadership roles, saying, come together, you know, let's talk. Let's look at mutual issues or mutual concerns. And I think it just takes, you know, a handful of people to make a difference. You know, we can definitely make a difference, but we got to join together. And so that's what we did many years ago. My program was a separate nonprofit for many years, and then we merged with Institute on Aging in 1997, because the mission of Institute on Aging is very similar to our mission, which is trying to help older people increase quality of life as we age and decrease loneliness and social isolation. And so my program is probably, what we actually do is try to help decrease depression. And one of the things, and I've seen this since, you know, for 37 years, is that in our society, whether we're talking about a primary care physician or we're talking about nurses, we're talking about case managers, is that people confuse depression with aging. And so we're not very good at recognizing the symptoms of depression because we confuse that with aging. And we have to get, you know, back to basics about that. And to say that aging itself isn't depressing. It's challenging. You know, I think it was Betty Davis that said many years ago, aging is not for sissies. You know, it takes a lot of effort. And I think just like with any age, we all have a contribution to make. And so for some of us, you know, getting down here from, say, Vacaville or wherever on the bus can be a little challenging, you know. And getting up in the morning, and as Bonnie was saying, when you're at these conferences, you kind of go from early morning till late at night. It's a lot of energy. And we could all say, I'm not doing it. You know, I'm going to stay home, and I'm going to watch daytime TV or listen to the radio. And if that doesn't kill us, you know, that's amazing. But the idea is that we come out. And the thing when I talk to people here at this conference is that, you know, what I know I'm talking to are healthy people, you know, active people, people who really want to participate and, you know, continue. As Bonnie was saying, even though, you know, she's retired, you know, now I have more time for volunteer work. I can do more things. You know, and I think that's really essential for us not to just think about our own needs, but to think about the people with whom we live, other older people who are our professional colleagues or are our friends in the buildings in which we live, because, you know, some of them may really be suffering. And it's not simply, oh, because I'm 65 or 75 or 85, but it may be that I'm anxious or I'm worried. One of the themes that we've seen on our 24-hour telephone line in the last 3 years, the top discussion piece of our callers has been, am I going to outlive my financial resources? And that is a big thing, particularly as we all know with this, what we're calling a recession for these last several years, is particularly hard on anybody that has a fixed income. You know, and we know that we're living longer. You know, the 85-plus age category is the fastest-growing age category in America today. Welcome. Come on in. I'll just wait till you get seated. Sure. We're glad you're here. Do you want to say your name and where you're from? Welcome. We're glad you're here. Thank you. And my name is Patrick Arbour, and I'm talking about our 24-hour telephone line. So that theme about anxiety that's connected to limited resources or fears that I'm going to outlive my resources is a particularly pressing one that people need to address. I'm going to say the number for our 24-hour line. And Bonnie said that this is going to be archived, so you'll find it on, what is it that they'll find it on?
On the CCB website. And also there will be an article in the Blind Californian, hopefully the next quarter, that'll have some phone numbers for you.
Okay, great. So so you know that the number will be listed elsewhere. The 800 number is 1-800-971-0016. And I'll repeat it. It's 1-800-971-0016. And, you know, and so if this is a resource for yourself or someone you know, we hope that you will, you know, tell people about it. Yes. And I'll just repeat his question. Is this number for the whole state of California or just Northern California? The 800 number is for anyone across the country. So it's California and also the United States. We get calls from Florida, from New York, from, you know, Arizona, wherever. And how people hear about it is exactly what we're doing today, which is for whatever reason, I'm blessed that people think I have something to say. And they invite me to conferences, and so I talk about our friendship line. And what I've found is word of mouth is far more powerful as a tool than billboards, you know. And when someone says, I called the 24-hour friendship line and people were kind to me or responsive to me, I think that that is very helpful. So word of mouth, I think, is very powerful as a communication tool. The other themes that come up, and I just want to welcome you two who just walked in. And you just want to say your name for us? I know. Yes. Right. And Amy's going to be speaking next after I finish. So we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
And I'm always happy to share the you know. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I was just saying our 24-hour 800 number for our friendship line is 1-800-971-0016. And I do. I have some brochures.
Okay, great.
So I'll leave them up here. Yeah, it is on there. It's 971-0016. 1-800. And, you know, and if you, for whatever reason, want to reach me, you're welcome to call that number and just ask for me, and the volunteer or the staff person will get your message to me, and then I'm happy to call you back. And I can give Bonnie my direct line, too. And you could add that into any kind of material that you're going to use for a newsletter or whatever. And the other theme that I wanted to talk about, too, and Amy will probably talk about that more in terms of, you know, breaking through isolation and again, participating with other seniors. But I wanted to talk a little bit about another big theme that comes up on our 24-hour line and also give you just a little glimpse at the breadth of the issues that come up. Each month on our 24-hour line, we receive about 2,000 incoming calls per month on our line, and we make about 3,000 outgoing calls per month. And it's the outreach calls that are very important because it's a link to people who might otherwise spend a lot of time alone. And so we call them, and it's not a call that says, are you alive? Isn't that great? Goodbye. But we know that there are a lot of those kinds of, you know, kind of computer-driven companies that provide that. If you don't answer the phone, then they're going to contact some kind of emergency service. And, you know, I would imagine there's room for that. But for us, that's not really our point. Our point is that we want to connect with people. We really believe that loneliness and isolation are the breeding ground for depression. And it's not so much a matter of, you know, oh, you're still there, isn't that great? I mean, we appreciate that too, but that's not really the point. The point is we want to connect with you. What are you thinking about today? What are you experiencing today? You know, what's on your mind? What's in your heart? Is this an anniversary date of a loved one that that died? Is this, you know, a season, even with the seasons changing, can trigger a lot of, you know, memories. You know, we can become quite sentimental. But when we're just sitting there by ourselves, it can be a really lonely kind of experience. And you know that when you talk to your friends. I'm sure that many of you here have been very pleased to see old friends or old committee members. I don't mean old, old. I mean, you know, that you've seen over time. And thank you. Yes, it is okay to be old. And it just feels good to catch up, to say, you know, these are some of the things that I'm dealing with. What are you dealing with? And it really helps. I see that I was mentioning that I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in September. And so it was, as I said, it was problematic in the beginning. But what I find is that it's so heartening to be able to talk to other people who say, oh, yeah, I've been diagnosed too. And to just share that can really reduce some of that pain that comes from acknowledging our mortality, you know, that, you know, it's about, life is really about impermanence, and it's about how we respond to losses and changes and transitions as we age. And I just think it's really crucial, and that aspect that we deal with a lot with our program has to do with grief and loss. And we run groups. We have a Saturday morning drop-in group. It's a drop-in traumatic loss group. We do 8-week structured groups around loss and trauma. And we have monthly drop-in groups as well. And then certainly on our phone lines, we deal with issues related to loss quite often. Come on in. I'll just wait till you guys get seated. We're very patient. We don't mind. Yeah. Welcome, Roger and Bernice. There's chairs right there. That's fine. We're glad you're here. And then there you go. There's a chair behind you. Welcome. And so we're just talking about some of the issues that we deal with at our 24-hour friendship line for the elderly. And grief and loss is certainly one that we also deal with. And, you know, the thing about grief in our culture is that we're a quick fix culture. What we say to people, it doesn't matter who they are, how old they are, is, aren't you over that yet? Why talk about that? It's so depressing, you know. I've had people come to me who are in their, you know, 70s, 80s and said, you know, that my, you know, adult child died 3 weeks ago or 4 months ago, and people are saying to them, oh, don't talk about that. It's too depressing. You know, think about other things, you know, and that is called avoidance and denial. What we need to do is to be able to grieve our losses. You know, to be able to talk about our loved ones who've died and to know that somebody wants to listen to you, you know. One of the themes of hopelessness has to do with people not remembering that we actually were here on this planet. And one of the ways to combat hopelessness is to be able to say to somebody, I can remember those who have died before me. And if others are willing to talk to me about that person is still living, you know, in a different form, but they're with us more spiritually. We recognize their contributions on the planet. And if somebody's willing to talk to me or listen to me about my loved ones, maybe, just maybe, someone will remember me when I die. And that fills me with hope. That we will be remembered. I can't tell you how many people will call on our lines or talk to me and say, you know, who cares that I'm even here? You know, who cares? And I say, I care. And I'm sure Amy cares. And I'm sure Bonnie cares. And I'm sure all of you care. And what we have to do is to really remind people that it's okay to talk about what's really going on in our lives. And for those of you that know people in their 80s, certainly mid-80s, is a time when a lot of peers die or disappear, you know. And we need to say, hey, I got some feelings about this, you know. I'm concerned that a person, I had this one woman said to me, I talk to my friend every day on the phone. We went to high school together. We went to community college together. We've been friends all these years. And she said one day she didn't call me. And so I called her back and nobody answered. And next month, the month after that. And she said, oh, my God, what happened? It took her about 9 months to find out that her friend had fallen and broken a hip, wound up in a convalescent center. And because she had no family members, then she was unable, because of other problems that occurred as she was in the convalescent center, she was moved out of county to a residential care facility that she could afford, but she had no phone. Nobody was offering to help her. And so, you know, she was worried that her friend thought, oh my God, what happened to me? It took her 9 months because then she was also confused and she had some early stage dementia. And when your whole life becomes turned around, it's very hard to kind of, where are my phone numbers? You know, I'm not even sure the names right now of my people. And so it took her 9 months before a volunteer, not a staff member at this residence, a volunteer finally understood what she was trying to say and tracked down the friend and called her. And, you know, but these things occur, you know, and we need to strengthen our commitments to one another and also to be resources for one another. And if somebody is grieving and grief doesn't care about what time of day, grief doesn't operate during business hours only. And people sometimes just need to talk to somebody at 8 p.m. Well, they can call the 24-hour warm line. And if somebody is really having a hard time and making phone calls isn't easy or convenient, as I said, we make 3,000 outgoing calls per month. So we call out to people. And that feature, and again, it doesn't matter where the individual lives, whether you're in Calaveras County or Sacramento or wherever, we will call you and we will say, you know, let's talk for a little while. How are you doing? And so that's very important. The other thing, too, that a lot of people want to talk to us about has to do with their own realization that their life will be coming to an end at some point. And it's important that we be able to find a safe way, a supportive way of talking about something that no one wants to talk about in this country, and that has to do with death. Some of you might be familiar with Maury Schwartz, if you saw that Nightline interview with him many years ago, or if you read Tuesdays with Maury, that kind of thing. He was such a pioneer because he said, we need to talk about this. We need to be able to grieve all that we will have to let go of as we have to deal with illnesses or other kinds of issues. You know, people often say to me, oh, well, this person died of old age, and that just makes me crazy because nobody dies of old age. You know, that is not a cause of death in our society. It's not, you know, on the 20 leading causes of death because, it again, to me, that's a stigma about what it means to age. People do not die of old age. People die of heart disease or cancer or whatever, diabetes or dementia. They do not die of old age. But he was the one who said, you know, he was dying as a result of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a very insidious disease. And but he was such a courageous person because he said, you know, we need to bring this out into the open. We need to talk about what it means to have to deal with death. What I'd like to do, and I want to read to you this wonderful brief essay that was written by a retired social worker. Reminds me very much of Bonnie here. And her name was Doris, and she was from the San Diego region. And I was giving a talk there one day, and we were talking about grief and loss, death and dying. And she was very eloquent. She got up and she talked about her own thoughts about death. And I said, oh my gosh, it would be so great to have that written down because you were so eloquent. And she said, well, let me see if I can recreate it and I'll send it to you, my thoughts on death. And it's just very important. And so she sent me this essay called Thinking About Death. And she really brought to the front and center what all of us as we age have to ponder at some point. And these are her thoughts about death. She said, I've been thinking about death. Not death in general, but my own. It began when a faraway friend who always sent me a birthday card didn't this year, and I learned she died the month after my last birthday. How easily that could have been the other way around. So I make my will, arrange my affairs, talk frankly with my children about cremation, donating body parts, funeral services, and dealing without guilt with the loss that will be me. I see myself an enlightened woman trying to make death real. I say aloud, I will not always be. I will not always be. But my stomach tightens at the thought of my me dissolving into the void. I contemplate afterlife and decide reincarnation and transmigration, despite my great love of travel, are for others and not for me. I know she's wonderful. I admit in the smugness of an earlier time to a fantasy of my wisdom and example living on, even flourishing in those whose lives I would touch. I know now those close to me will find themselves as blessed and plagued, as enlightened and baffled by their legacy as I have been with mine. Regarding heaven and hell, I have neither enthusiasm nor trepidation and recognize I would make a poor candidate in either place. So where am I left in my reflections on death? Confused. Confused is the word, and more often bemused at my reluctance to accept this new neighbor from whom I can never move. It's come to this. One day I may welcome death, but for now I choose to pass him by with a nod, head up, inhaling sun and wind, words, visions, sweat of bodies, aroma of rising dough, hugs, hurts, flute songs, a baby's hand curled around my finger, and I celebrate the mix and tang and wonder that is my moment and myself. And I think that she speaks in such a graceful, humorous, but also courageous way that at some point we must recognize that I may not be able to move from this new neighbor, and that new neighbor is death, you know, and we need to be able to talk about it, you know, and find meaning, you know, as Josie and I were talking about earlier, you know, who am I now at the age of 75 or 72? Thank you, Josie, for that correction. But whatever our age, we need to still realize that I have a contribution to make. And that's what we try to establish on our 24-hour friendship line, is a place where people can say, I'm a little confused, you know, right now, as Doris says in her essay on death, I'm a little confused. I'm not quite sure what I think about this. And so Friendship Line would be a place that one can have a meaningful conversation about topics that otherwise in our society, most people don't want to talk about. And I think it's really incumbent on us to be able to find a path to enlightenment around who I have been in society, but who I am also going to be, because I'm still here. And what I really believe so much is that this moment is as critical to our living as a big event. My son's mother is in Tacoma at her aunt's 90th birthday celebration, and I was talking to her aunt on the phone today, and I was recognizing that. But it made me think that it's not the big events that I hold on to. It's the little moments of life, you know. It's sitting here at this conference with maybe people you haven't met before or new people and exchanging thoughts and ideas, laughter, you know, meaning about what life is for us today. Those little moments, to me, really make a life. Big events are interesting. But if I only lived in anticipation of some event down the road, I really wouldn't be in this moment. And so our friendship line and our volunteers and staff really want to remind people that the moment that we're in is the big event. You know, this is it. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to. Do you want to say, Roger, first, what your question is?
One of the things I just wanted to comment on, first of all, there are two things. One is the recently had that happen where we found that one of our friends had died.
Ah.
By finding her phone number and calling her up because we hadn't heard from her about a meeting.
Right.
You realize that relationships between people who, people are very far away from each other, but even who don't, the relationships are pretty tenuous.
Yeah, let me just say that for the...
who's next of kin and stuff, I don't know. I don't know how to find out
Yeah, let me just say this so that everybody heard what you were talking about. What Roger is just commenting on is just that the difficulty that happens with people, whether they live far away or whether they live in your area, if something happens to them, how do you know that? You know, how do you find that out? And those relationships are really important. That's right, that you might not have the depth of knowledge about who's close to them. And one of the things that I really advocate for is getting those phone numbers, of other people. I'm just going to give you the phone or the microphone.
Sorry. The other thing I wanted to mention is that when you're talking about avoiding subjects, there's a pet peeve that I have. In interest of full disclosure, I'm kind of non-religious or maybe even anti-religious, but one of the things I'm anti is what I call superstition. And in this culture, it seems as though a lot of people believe in word magic. They think if you say something, it'll happen. And that keeps people from talking about things they need to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said that really beautifully. Thank you, Roger. I'm just going to pass the microphone around, then I don't have to repeat.
Okay, what kind of volunteers do you have when they answer the phones and you call the 3,000 calls you make?
So in terms of the volunteers, we have and as Bonnie and others of you here, if you've ever worked with volunteers, they are precious commodities. They are like, diamonds. They're so necessary. And so we have a wide range of volunteers. We have retired social workers who are saying, I still want to give back to the community. We have retired nurses. We have people like that. We have people in the community who, for example, one woman I'm thinking about, she had gotten her gerontology degree probably 20-some years ago, and she just says, I just want to continue working with older people. I'm retired, but I want to continue working. We have...
of course, the other people are always the older people, not you.
That's right. Mae Sarton said, if you're familiar with Mae Sarton, this prolific writer, she always read the New York Times obituary column, and she said, I read it because who died? Not I. And that's the same thing. Who's old? People who are, that I'm five years younger than are old. I'm not. But the volunteers are also master-level students in the helping profession. They're also bachelor-level students. And community members who really just want to give back, because we operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we have to have a large pool of people to draw upon. And then I'm also blessed to have a really lovely staff. We have, including myself, we have 4 full-time staff members and 1 part-time staff member, 2 licensed clinical social workers, a former physician from the Philippines, and a young lady who just got her psychology degree from San Francisco State. It's a big operation, but we have a lot of people that have big hearts. They're all trained, and we do ongoing training and supervision with them on a regular basis because some of the calls we get are from people that are having really hard times. And so we want to make sure that, that the volunteer has a place to talk about their feelings as well. Anybody else? I saw somebody else had their hand up. Let me come around because I'll just... have you speak into the microphone, if you don't mind.
Here, Lorraine. Okay, thank you. Hi, my question is, are volunteers stationed in San Francisco, and what does someone do to sign up to volunteer?
Oh, Laura Lee, I called you Lorraine. In terms of volunteers, we also have volunteers. We've had people that have low vision volunteers. We have people who are... need to be in wheelchairs, and we do all we can to accommodate them. Our call office, our call center, is in San Francisco. But if anybody may be interested or has the capacity to, what we look for are people who can operate the lines from 8 at night till 8 in the morning, which you can do in your home. It doesn't matter to us whether you're in San Francisco or Vacaville or wherever. We can transfer the calls to you and train you to be able to do that. And there's a stipend attached to that as well. So that could be a helpful resource for people. So you don't have to necessarily be at the call center. Yes, Jane.
I hate to use the word lost because I didn't lose her. My best friend for over 50 years, Carol Simpson, died. And, you know, you can't replace those friendships. But I think in staying active and doing for others, you know, you somehow can help. And, you know, being involved with CCLVI, for example, or I'm on the new health plan for the state of California for people on Medicare, Medi-Cal, and in-home supportive services board. And I just think the more active we stay, the more we think about others and not ourselves so much, and I think that helps.
Yeah, I just really want to second that, and that makes a really good segue to Amy, because staying active, sharing, participating is so crucial. Joe, I'm coming back here so you can use the microphone.
It's pretty short. I just was wondering, how do you get funded, and do you have fundraising, or is it grants, or how do you fund this whole project?
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Funding, as you know, particularly for nonprofits, is always a juggling act. So we have a state grant. It's from Cal Mesa, which is the California Mental Health Services Authority Program, which we recently got, and that's a three-year grant, and we're really grateful. We have the Department of Aging and Adult Services in City and County of San Francisco has been a very kind grantor for us over the years and values and appreciates the work we do. We also do fundraisers. We have at the holiday time, we do a cable car caroling event. And if you're in the City and County of California, please contact us and we'd be happy to talk to you about that. I started this 26 years ago. This will be our 26th. We go around on motorized cable cars to older people that participate in our program, and we try to bring some sense of holiday joy to people. And it's really a fun, nice event. And then donations are always accepted. And so as with many services in nonprofits, you have to stitch together all of these different kind of tributaries of support to create this program, which I always see as kind of a large quilt, and we need to have, everybody has to help us and participate. Robert.
Earlier when you talked about people calling in at the end of their life, they don't have enough finances, do you make reference to people where resources or funds might be available for them?
Yeah, where we can, we try to help and offer referrals, you know, or resources to people. You know, it's a very complicated system in terms of getting help. So we try to do our best. If we know that there are certain organizations or foundations that would be able to offer a stipend or support, we'll try to guide people to that. But as I'm sure you know here, that's a very complex kind of situation. And then what we try to do, if we don't know, we'll try to direct them to an agency that may be better knowledgeable in that area. I know Amy is getting ready to participate here, so I'm going to close off because I have to go to work. I would love to spend time with you, but I'm not able to do that. But it's really been very great to be here with you all today. I'm glad that you were able to come. Thank you very much. If there's anything I can do, Bonnie knows how to reach me. She has all my numbers, so she can get to me, and I'd be happy to talk to you if I could be of any help. Enjoy the rest of your conference, and I'm going to give the mic back to Bonnie. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And Yes, if anyone wants more info, probably the easiest thing to do, call the CCB office. Most of you know that number. Refer them to me, or ask to be referred to me if you like. And as I say, there'll be an article later. I want to...
Bye,
Patrick. Thank you so much again. What a wonderful resource. In fact, we are really so blessed today. We have two of the best resources.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. That was a perfect segue, huh? And I am just so excited. I finally get to meet Amy here. I have talked to Amy on the phone many times, emailed, and I do feel like I know her because I do. Ah, hugs. Very good. Excellent. And in fact, I will have a question for Amy that we sort of ran out of time with Patrick, but Amy also can address this whole thing of dealing with health challenges and grief and loss and all that. Amy Shadle is the associate director of the Senior Center Without Walls, and I learned about this program through networking. I realized we had a presentation 2 years ago when we were in this hotel from Terry Englehart, the director, and, you know, that was 2 years ago. It's still going strong. Some of you didn't hear that. And one reason we're asking for a presentation, we really want you to, good old word of mouth, let your friends, if you like these programs that are available to people free on the telephone, what could be better, then please let your friends know after you've heard the presentations, because it's one way you can actually help someone. So I'm going to give the microphone to Amy. She'll tell from here what she wants to, and we'll do the same thing with the questions, and she'll decide how she wants to handle the questions. So take it away, Amy.
Thank you, Bonnie. And thank you so much for the invitation to speak to everyone here this morning. It's an honor and pleasure to be with all of you. I'd like to know, does anyone want a drink of water? Because I'd be happy to get you a glass of water. There's water in the back of the room. Raise your hand. Are you thirsty? Do you want to stand up and stretch? Patrick is one of my heroes, and I think you all agree that he's an incredible man, and he's done incredible work for our community. And one of the things that he said struck my heart straight in the center, and that is about the different ways we can strengthen our commitment to each other and strengthen our relationships and cherish the ones that we have and have had that are still ongoing. As Bonnie said, I'm the associate director of Senior Center Without Walls. And what Senior Center Without Walls is a free telephone group activities program. We're sponsored by Episcopal Senior Communities. We're part of their outreach programs. And we've been in existence for 8 years. And essentially, what we do is we have different types of activities and events and conversational groups all on the phone for free for elders who live in the state of California, anywhere in the state of California. And the way that we do that, the infrastructure, is remember the old-time party lines when you picked up the phone and said, Mabel, get off, I got to call my girl? Well, nowadays, with technology, we have what we call conference calling. So not only do you get Mabel on one line, we could get everybody in this room on one line. So all of the groups are done as conference calls, and it's really easy to connect to these groups. When someone registers with us to join in the program, we give them a 1-800 number that connects to all of the groups that we do during the week. They dial the 1-800 number. Let's say that you want to call into Challenges of Aging, a group that I've been doing for 7 years, every Monday morning at 10 o'clock. So Monday 10, you dial the 1-800 number. You hear an automated voice whom we have dubbed Hortense. You hear Hortense say, please enter your conference code. And each one of our groups has a two-digit code number. And the one for challenges is 33. So you press 33 on your telephone. You hear a beep, and that means you're connected to the group. And every single one of our groups has a facilitator. They're incredible volunteers. Some are our own participants. Others are retired professionals, such as Bonnie. Bless her heart. Thank you. And they hear the beeps as people call in, and they welcome folks. And the group, depending upon what type it is, continues from there. So it's a very simple process. You don't need any special equipment, a landline, your phone. You don't even have to comb your hair, get out of bed, or change out of your pajamas. You can stay comfortable at home. And the program originated when Terry Engelhardt, its director, was working in the community doing information and referral to older adults, and she noticed, oh my gosh, there are so many older adults who live alone, are doing fairly well, you know, maintaining their independence because they want to stay at home, they want to stay in their neighborhood, they want to stay connected to their community, but are having a difficult time getting out and about and connecting and socializing. And she thought, there must be a way to get folks to come together. And so one day she was shopping and she went into this big box store and she saw this huge banner hanging from the ceiling that said, conference call cards, big sale. So she figured, you know what? I wonder if my friends would like to call in on a conference call and have some fun and just talk with each other. So that's what she did. She started all by herself with two groups, which she did. One was Pet Tales, a group for people who'd like to animals to talk about their pets and pets that they have had, and also Funny Bones, where people came together to tell jokes and funny stories. That was 8 years ago. Slowly, it grew. More and more people became interested in connecting with others by telephone. Fascinating. And so she recruited her sister, her brother-in-law. She called all of her friends, including me. And, of course, I love Terry. I said, of course, I'll be happy to do a group. And then I hung up and I thought, that's just such a screwball idea. How can you get people to call and bond over the telephone? And that was 8 years ago, and I'm here to tell you that when I talk about Senior Center Without Walls, I call it a community because it truly is a community. I'm going to stop for a second, and because I like to answer people's questions as I go along, that way, I know you're listening. Huh? Does anyone have a question right now? First, I'm going to go to Roger.
I wanted to ask, how do you identify who's on a call and keep track of who's who in your groups? That seems to be a problem on calls I've been on.
Absolutely, and depending upon the group, the size of the group varies anywhere between 5 to 10. Hardly any more than that is in a group. Our facilitators are trained to take roll and write down names, and after a couple of calls, Roger, you know that you can start recognizing voices, and people are very, very courteous, especially when they know that they will have a chance to speak. No one is put on the spot. If people don't want to participate, they're more than welcome to call in and just listen. That's swell. But for those who like to have a word or two, our facilitators are trained to always make space to ask, Roger, haven't heard from you lately. Do you have something to add? Do you have a comment? And that's how we keep track, Roger.
Someone just come on the line and not identify themselves.
That's correct. We ask all of our participants when they call, and after the beep, they say, oh, well, this is Roger, and we use first names only when we're in the groups. And Laura Lee, thank you. You had a question?
Just how do you register?
Registration is very easy. You just call the office, and we register people over the phone. And we're not interested in a lot of data. All we ask is your name, your telephone number, your mailing address, because sometimes we have these great handouts we like to mail to people upon their request. And we also ask for your birth date. You don't have to give the year, but we ask for your birth date because we like to send birthday cards to our community. And Terry, Jennifer, and I, on your birthday, will call you and sing happy birthday to you. So be forewarned. I see a question in the back, and let me run down the aisle. Oh. Since we're a telephone program, it behooves me to give you some sort of telephone number. I'd like you to know that, and I will, and thank you for asking. I'd like you to know that I have brochures at the front table here about our program, which has our telephone number on the back, and our website and our email address. I also, at Bonnie's suggestion, brought some cassette tapes, a few cassette tapes, and oh my gosh, oh here they are, a few CDs of what we call our catalog, which tells you a little bit about our program, but more importantly tells you what the groups and classes and special events are during our sessions. And I'll back up and tell you a little bit more about that. But our telephone number, and it's a toll-free number, is 1-877-797-7299. I lost myself, Josie. No. Start over. 1-877-797-7299. You're welcome. You're welcome. We have 3 12-week sessions every year. And during these 12 weeks, we have anywhere between 45 to 60 different groups that our folks can call into. They're scheduled Monday through Sunday throughout each day at different times. Remember when you went to high school and, you know, you had geometry at 2 and history at 11 in the morning, a class which I like to skip. 9:54? 4 minutes, yeah, well, I would have missed more than history then. I'll give you, with your permission, sort of a listing of the groups that we offer, and we include new groups and refresh old groups and keep well-beloved traditional groups with each different session. For example, we play bingo over the telephone. And you go, and how do you do that, pray tell? So we send the bingo cards to folks who sign up to play bingo. And we have this incredible volunteer who's been calling bingo for the past 5 years. Her name is Gloria. And quite frankly, I'd be dingbatty if I were Gloria, but she loves it. And so she calls bingo. We have some really hardcore, dedicated bingo players, as you might imagine. And every session, they don't play for money, but we send them little prizes, you know, over the telephone, because, I mean, after all, it's fun and it's hard work. And as we have a book club, we have a writing group, we have a conversational group called Coffee Break, where people call just to chit-chat over their cup of tea or cocoa or coffee. We have, for the foodies out there, we have a group called Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. Folks are always swapping recipes. And there's a healing circle. Terry really loves it when we can offer groups that help keep our, you know, dendrites stretchy and our synapses firing. So we have groups called Fun with Trivia and Mind Massage. I did a silent group meditation this past session. And I'm also currently facilitating a group on death and dying for our program. There's Movie Madness for movie buffs and musical shares where people sing. It is so phenomenal. I have to tell you, during our special events, every Friday between 3 and 4 o'clock, we have a special event, and they vary. Sometimes we do a travelogue where one of our friends who has traveled to India or Peru, they get on the phone and they take you on a virtual trip with them. Sometimes we have interviews with authors. Sometimes we celebrate holidays, and St. Patrick's Day, I had the pleasure of facilitating that particular special event, and we totally rocked it. We sang, you would have thought that we were sitting in a tavern with a mug of ale, or several mugs of ale in front of us. And I told them, I said, the next time that I do a presentation about Senior Center Without Walls, I am going to have to say that if you haven't tried it, it sounds a little weird, but you can actually hear everyone, and you can hear yourself singing into the phone as well. And we were pretty good, I have to tell you. We also do a group called Support Vision. We do a vision loss support group, and that is a peer support group where folks who are dealing with vision loss get together and support each other and share resources. We're also fortunate enough to have a partnership with the Braille Institute of Santa Barbara, and they do a support for the blind group for us. What else? Oh, use your brain to change your age. Tall tales. How many of you lie? Can you do it on purpose? Tall tales is a group that we started, I guess, maybe 3 sessions ago, and no one wants to let go of it. I guess they were. I guess they act out during the group. But Tall Tales is where each participant, if he or she chooses to, tells a brief little story, and everyone else in the group has to figure out, is it true or not true? Yes, and so I've been making certificates for the biggest liars of the group, because they ought to have something to commemorate their skill, right? We serve a little over 1,000 people every year, and each session, it keeps growing. Each session, we have over 300 people sign up for our program. Yeah. And when people call into these groups week after week, and they can bebop around as much as they want to, we tell people they can call in when they want to, they can hang up at any time. No one's feelings are going to get hurt. You know, maybe you hear your cat throwing up a hairball and you have just got to get to it and you need to hang up the phone, or Meals on Wheels comes to the door and it's your favorite person. You can hang up at any time. And You can call into as many groups as you wish. We have some people who call in 5-6 times a day. We have some folks who call in maybe 6 times a month. And sometimes we have people who sign up and call in maybe just 3 times during the entire session. What did I want to say? Oh, yes. Okay. So the majority of our folks are women, as you might guess. But we have some stellar gentlemen calling in. And I really admire them because, you know, for a guy to hold his own in a group with 8 other women, I mean, that takes sensitivity and wisdom. And so, yeah, but the most of our community are women. And we have our 50-year-olds and we have our 90-year-olds. And I'm telling you, if you make it to your 90s, you are going to be fabulous. Not that you're not fabulous right now, but truly, our 90-year-olds give me a run for my money. I can't keep up with them. But the majority of our folks are somewhere between their mid-70s to late 80s, I would say. And they, all walks of life, from women who have done incredible and hard work, being housewives and mothers and contributing to their communities, to retired professionals, professors and nurses. And it's interesting, we have a lot of retired social workers calling in. We do. I'm going to stop for a second. Who has a question? Anyone? Here, let me come to you, Susan.
I don't actually have a question, but you can tag this on to your Tall Tales group. When I was in college, I took a class, and it was called Folklore and Tall Tales, or something like that order.
Folklore and Tall Tales. Well, we've got some professionals calling into our group. We thank you, Susan, and we all, because it reminds me, we do read alouds as well. Terry has been reading aloud from a novel, and I have been reading aloud from Up in the Old Hotel by Joseph Mitchell. And we've done Greek myths and fairy tales. Any other questions? The catalog is online, Roger. We have a really wonderful website. It's clear and concise, and I know you've heard the term user-friendly, but I'm truly a nerd, and I insisted that this website be something that I enjoyed and could use too. Yes, Jane.
I did join for a while, but now I have kind of dropped off because I couldn't find things that really interested me. And I wonder how often you change the program and how somebody knows when you do change.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that, Jane. And thank you for giving us a try. Every 12 weeks. So we're in our last week of our spring session, Jane, and our new summer session will begin at the end of May. So for everyone who has been a participant in our spring session, they automatically get one of our new summer catalogs. For those who would like a catalog, just give us a call. We're just thrilled to share information about our program. And so if you just give us a call, we'll put it in the mail to you. And you're probably still in our database, Jane, so you should... Thank you, Jane. Thank you. That's really good. Oh, okay. Here I come.
Here's the microphone, Laura Lee. Okay, thank you. Since one group is ending now and there's nothing till the end of May, do people have any ability to call in between the quarters? Are there any ongoing things?
Laura Lee, did you used to run a program? Are you a program director? Exactly. What we're launching into now, and I don't, who knows what time it is? Someone tell me what time it is, please. I have 10 minutes. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. So, Laura Lee, to answer your question, we are, after the spring session ends, we move into what we call our intra-term. Way back in the early days, when we had, you know, three sessions, and there would be like maybe 5-4 weeks in between each session, people would have to go cold turkey and not have anything to call into. We remedied that right away by instituting what we call an intra-term, which is a very abbreviated curriculum of groups that people can call into. One reason why we have the intra-term, Laura Lee, is we, as Patrick said, treasure our volunteers. They are precious diamonds, and so we ask them to take a break if they so choose. Some don't, but most do. And also the office, there's Terry, myself, and Jennifer, who is half-time because she has a beautiful 2-year-old daughter at home. We create the curriculum for the new session. So between our spring and our summer sessions is a 5-week intra-term, and there are about 20 different groups that people can call into and still keep in touch. Yes. And one of the things that I really wanted to say is that people get to know each other after calling into these groups, and some of our folks have been with us for 7-6 years, and they take a shine to each other, you know? Josie might take a shine to Jane in the Eat, Drink, and Be Merry group. Roger and Robert might meet during the current events group and go, hey, I want to talk to this guy. We ask that people not exchange their personal phone numbers while they're in a group. We're really protective of everybody's privacy, and we try and keep information as confidential as possible. But what we do encourage is folks, if they want to exchange phone numbers, is to call the office and say, Roger will call the office and say, Amy, you know, I think Robert and I would like to chat outside of the program because he's got a few ideas about our political system I need to straighten him out about. And so you have my permission to give my telephone number to Robert. And then I would call Robert and say, hey, Robert, there's this guy in current events named Roger who thinks that you're you need to be straightened out. And this is his telephone number, and if you'd like, you can give him a call. And if I have your permission, I can give your number to Roger. So that's how it's done. And I have to tell you, after 8 years, we have the most remarkable telephone tree. I mean, you cannot imagine. People who live 200, 300, 5 miles away from each other, who will probably never, ever see each other, but who treasure each other and the relationship that they have the ability to connect. And it makes me think of something that all of you discussed with Patrick, in terms of relationships and not knowing, you know, sometimes what happens with our friends, our loved ones, until much, much later. One of the reasons why I can say our telephone community is a community is that the office is forever getting calls. Laura Lee will call and say, you know, Amy, I've been calling into Pet Tales this session. I really love it. One of the reasons why I love it is Bonnie has the funniest stories about her cats. And you know what? The past two weeks, she hasn't called in. Can you call her and find out what's happening? And so I call Bonnie just to see what's up, just to see what's happening. And if she needs a little, you know, support or some information, happy to give her what she needs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And folks will tell us, you know, Amy, I'm going in for a hip replacement. Let everyone know. Or, you know, I'm getting cataract surgery. Do you know anyone who has had cataract surgery? Because I want to talk to them. I love our community very much. Let's see. I'm trying to think of what I've said and whether... Oh, hello, Bonnie. I'm sorry. I had my back to you. I was in the crowd.
There you go. Well, thanks to my husband for getting us together there.
Here's the microphone.
Oh, thanks. Well, just a couple of things, and I see our time is winding down. But first of all, to dovetail on what Patrick said, maybe you could talk about this a little from your Challenges of Aging group, for example. How, I mean, I know the main reason that people join is to have fun, to get, you know, friendly conversation. We do it because it's enjoyable. I believe that there are some real benefits overcoming isolation and keeping our minds active among them. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, people that have changing health issues, because we didn't get to talk about this with Patrick, how a group such as yours can sort of support people and maybe... on the positive side, I don't want people to think that there are nonstop pity parties, because sometimes people are afraid of that. Oh, I don't want to talk to a group of people, and can you top this with your aches and pains? No, I
won't allow that.
Indeed. The positive things that can be gained from someone to talk to about those challenges, not that you end up leaving feeling worse than when you came. Maybe you could talk about that.
Absolutely.
Just a little.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you so much. Challenges of Aging is a peer support group, and it has been one of the most remarkable gifts in my life. The way that Challenges of Aging works is that it is a peer support group held in a very safe, respectful, and compassionate time frame. And it's a place where people can come and speak what's in their minds, but most importantly, what's in their hearts, and what they're fearful of or what they're angry about. And it's amazing the different topics that come up. Nobody sees me. Nobody hears me. I'm having an operation. I don't know what I'm in for. I was just diagnosed with cancer. My children, I gave them everything, and I don't hear from them, not even during Christmas time. All of these topics come up, and they come up in an atmosphere of openness. And one of the things that I request of the folks who call into Challenges of Aging is that we don't tell people what to do. We share similar experiences. We offer suggestions, gentle suggestions, and moral support. And I think each one of us knows sometimes when we have an opportunity to speak our fear, to speak our anger, and feel heard, that somehow it releases a lot of the negative energy and allows some fresh air to be blown into our brains and our spirits to feel a little looser and less tense. Hi, what did that little voice say? It was adorable.
That was my clock. I'm orienting myself.
So I have 3 minutes. Another thing is...
Is that right? Did I do my math right?
You actually have 4 minutes. My clock is fast.
I have done a group on death and dying every now and then. It's not an ongoing group, but... I advocate for it simply because, as Frances, who gives her age as, I'm almost 90. I love that. When she IDs herself in groups, she goes, this is Frances, I'm almost 90. Frances admits to all of us that she is thinking about death and, of course, specifically her own death. And she's not quite sure what she thinks. And she does know what she feels, and that is trepidation. And all that she wants is a place where it's okay to talk about our mortality and our thoughts and our feelings about our own mortality. And this is another group which I value because people are remarkably honest. It's interesting when you can't see the people that you're talking to, how sincere and open you can be. Anyway, I guess what I want to say is that when you call into Senior Center Without Walls, there are lots of different things going on. Some things you'll really grok and love, and other things, not so much. And maybe one or two things say, oh, gosh, I hope they take this off for next session. But for the most part, for all the parts, Senior Center Without Walls offers people who don't have an opportunity to be with other folks, to develop new friendships, to have a conversation with someone who understands what they're talking about. It gives these people a chance to connect and possibly strengthen their commitment to each other and, as equally important, their commitment to themselves. Groovy. 365 days a year, every morning at 9 o'clock, there is a gratitude group. It's so well attended, and it's very, very simply this. People call in, give their names to the facilitator, and the facilitator will say, Roger, what is your gratitude for today? Joan, what is your gratitude for today? Susan, what is your gratitude for today? And I ask each one of you to think of something you're grateful for. And so the gratitudes run, oh, how many times have I heard, I'm so grateful I got a good night's sleep last night. Oh, my gosh. I'm so grateful that I have a good hot cup of coffee in front of me. I'm so grateful that my grandson finally graduated high school. I'm so grateful for the birds that I hear singing outside. I'm grateful to be alive. It's a loving, sweet group, and we have so many people calling the office saying, I cannot imagine starting my day without calling into gratitude. We have lots of people calling in saying that the program has been a lifesaver for them, literally. And I think what they mean is that we all need our human connections. And Senior Center Without Walls, that's why we love our work, because at the heart of it, that's what we're trying to cultivate and nourish and maintain, a way for people to connect with each other. So I want to thank you. Do you want to know something? Okay, so some of you know San Mateo. We had a woman call in. She was extremely, and this was a couple of years ago, Roger, she was so depressed, and she would, and you know what happens to motivation when you're depressed, you have none. And she called in to Senior Center Without Walls reluctantly, And after a couple of years, she hardly calls in anymore because she insists on taking paratransit to where? The bowling alley. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. The bowling alley.
Bowling alleys are going away, though.
That's true, too.
Well, thank you, everyone. Really appreciate the time that we've spent together. And here's Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you, Amy. And let's give Amy a hand. Again, I really hope that we'll tell, even if you don't think this is a program for you this year, maybe it will be next year, who knows, but you have friends or acquaintances or people who need this info. Again, just to wrap up, it's Bernice is coming on next, and I know Amy and Bernice need to meet each other. And here's Bernice has the walker there. She's getting ready to come up.
I'm going to have Roger come and get the mic.
Oh, okay. And again, a plug for Seniors with Vision Loss Committee for CCB. Please strongly consider, give the office a call, ask for Bonnie's number if you want to know, well, what kind of help does she want? What does she think I have to offer? Or to say, hey, Bonnie, I think we need to be doing this, or let's have this kind of program. Please do that. We need more ideas, and mostly we need more help, you know, the old drill. So you have a lot to contribute. We need you in our Seniors with Vision Loss. And thank you very much to everyone.
Okay. Good morning. Mr. O'Farrell, are you in the room?
I sure am. Bruce.
Oh, come on up to the front. We're gonna now get an update on what's happening with identity theft. And Mr. O'Farrell is the executive director of the Identity Theft Council in Walnut Creek. So, huh? Okay. We will have a literature time, so just... Mr. O'Farrell?
Good to meet you.
Sorry, I'm not so mobile.
Sorry?
I'm not so mobile, sorry.
That's okay. No, this... So... Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks for inviting me, and thank you, Bernice, for thinking of us. As Bernice said, my name is Neil O'Farrell. I'm with the Identity Theft Council. We are a nonprofit established a couple of years ago in the Bay Area to help victims of identity theft. And actually, before I continue, if anyone has trouble hearing me, just put your hand up, and I'll shove the microphone closer to my mouth. Yeah, someone's already spotted that I'm not from around here. I'm from, I guess it's about 7,000 or 8,000 miles east of here in Ireland. So a little bit far from home, but it feels like home anyway. So the Identity Theft Council was started a couple of years ago when a bunch of us got together, cops, investigators, security experts, and we had figured out something that identity theft is just one of those crimes that doesn't seem to go away, and it seems to affect everyone. I don't think there are too many people who don't know someone who's been a victim of identity theft. By the way, if there is anyone in the room who has never heard of identity theft, let me just say welcome to our planet, and sorry about the mess. But you know, identity theft is one of those crimes that is just very few people either haven't heard of it or have, They know someone who's been a victim of it. And so we figured we ought to get together because law enforcement really can't do anything about this crime. It's one of the most amazing crimes in the history of law enforcement. I'll give you some statistics in a minute that'll kind of blow your mind. And then I'll go back and explain a bit more about what the council is, what it does, and how to contact us. So normally with presentations like this, I start with a simple opening. There's good news and there's bad news. I start with the bad news. Otherwise, the good news wouldn't sound as good. So here's the bad news, and please don't run for the exits. The bad news is bad, but the good news is better. Let me start with some statistics. Last year in the United States, it was estimated to be close to 12 million victims of identity theft. That's a million victims a month. Now, if you put that in perspective, that means that there were more victims of identity theft in the United States than there were victims of burglaries, attempted burglaries, auto thefts, vehicle thefts, arsons, purse snatchings, pickpocketings, and shoplifting combined. So if you break that down a little bit more, all of you who are really good at math, that means that there were five times more likely to be a victim of identity theft than a burglary. You're 15 times more likely to be a victim of identity theft than car theft. And you are 375 times more likely to be a victim of identity theft than a victim of purse snatching. So that's the bad news. There's good news, but I'm not there yet. There's more bad news. Because law enforcement is so overwhelmed with identity theft cases and victims, they've more or less given up on the crime. Law enforcement, if they're honest with you, will admit that they investigate less than 1% of identity thefts. That's the lowest of any crime in history. Of that 1%, only about 1% of those are ever prosecuted because prosecutors don't have enough evidence, judges aren't putting people away, you've got jurisdictional issues, all that kind of thing. So the bottom line is there's a very, very good chance you'll be a victim of identity theft, and there's also an equally good chance that no one will do anything about it. So that's what the Identity Theft Council got together. There's an awful lot more bad news, but I'm not going to ruin your day, so let me get straight to the good news. The good news is that 9 out of 10 identity thefts can be prevented by switching on the most powerful technology that you have available to yourself, and it's located right between your ears. Most identity thefts can be avoided simply by common sense. This is the beauty of this crime. You don't need high technology tools. You don't need expensive services. If you're just aware of how it happens and the very basic things that you can do to protect yourself, you'll be able to avoid most of these crimes. They're not a difficult crime to commit. That's why there are so many of them. And by the same token, it's not a difficult crime to avoid. So let me go back to why the council was formed. You've heard all those statistics. So now we have all these victims, a million a month with no one to turn to. So the Identity Theft Council created something you can turn to. So typically a victim of identity theft, the first thing they will do is go to their police department and get a police report and say, okay, my identity is being stolen. I either don't know who it is or I know exactly who it is, and I want you to saddle up, get a posse together and ride out over the hill and catch this person. And the police officer will look at you as though you're crazy. So what we wanted to do was to try and change that relationship, change that interaction. So for the first time in history, a cop will actually have something good to say to you. The good thing is we have a card that I'm holding, and I'll leave a lot of these here afterwards, and I'll also pass them on to Bernice. We have a business card that we distribute to law enforcement across the Bay Area in Northern California, and it has a 1-800 number. On it. It's got other contact information. It's got an email address. So essentially, if you're a victim of identity theft, you go into your local police department. They will give you this card. You can call our counselors, and we will take on your case, meaning we will fight off the debt collectors. We will fight off the creditors. We'll restore your identity. If you're fighting with your bank because they won't give you your money back, which quite often they won't, we'll do that on your behalf. We're all volunteers. No one gets paid, and we don't charge anything. We take on close to 80 cases a month right now. We could take on 10 times that number if the police were only less lazy and actually gave us more victims. Those counselors, they're trained, they're vetted. They will take you through the process of recovering your identity, filling out the paperwork. They will meet you locally. They'll sometimes meet you at your own home. And really, their goal is to help stop the bleeding. So that's essentially what the council does. I mean, we get referrals from all kinds of places. The FBI, the Secret Service, the Marshal Service will often refer victims to us. So that said, I guess the best thing I can do now that you know who we are and what the crime is, well, what you're going to do about it. So Here's the thing about identity theft. One of the reasons that it's so such a prolific crime is that it's so easy to commit. Every kind of individual you can imagine is involved in identity theft. That means local drug addicts, burglars, people who break into cars. They don't want the car. They want the information that's in your car. Organized crime. People who try and plant computer viruses on your computer and try and steal your information or your bank account information that way. People who steal purses. People who steal wallets. If they take your purse or your wallet, they almost throw away the cash these days. The cash is worth far less to them than the personal information that you might have in your purse or wallet. Absolutely. If you think about it, if a social security number in the black market can make $500 and you can sell it 1,000 times. So think about it. If they take $20 out of your purse, which is more valuable to them, that $20 that their fingerprint might be left on, or a social security number that they can sell and sell and sell. So, you know, information, personal information is the new currency for the thief. Another problem with identity theft is that many of the thefts are committed by people that you know and trust. This is particularly prevalent in the senior community, unfortunately, where you perhaps have am I speaking too loudly, by the way? Am I too close to the mic? Is it? Okay. Is that better? Okay, I'll try and stay away from it. Free. Okay. Yeah, I was saying that a major area of identity theft is with seniors and the elderly. And quite often the thieves, the perpetrators, are their own family. And quite often the reason is that the members of the family don't actually believe that it's a crime. So you've got an elderly parent or a grandparent who's worked all their life. They've got a stellar credit reputation. They've got lots of equity in the home. They don't owe much money. They've got a great credit score. And the kids think, well, I'm out of work, you know. Times are hard. I can't make my own payments. I can't afford to send the kids to college. I can't afford that new car I've always wanted. Or I can't afford that medical care. So they tap into the parents' or the grandparents' identity without them knowing about it. We have a case in Oakland, for example, an 82-year-old woman who was on the hook for more than $250,000 worth of debt because of identity thieves. Someone had purchased a Lexus in her name. She hasn't driven in 20 years. They took out a dozen credit cards in her name. They remortgaged her home. They sold her retirement home out from under her. So we were called in to help this poor lady, and she was a feisty lady. She was absolutely determined to figure out who did this and bring him to the law. She had 6 children. It turns out 5 of them were the thieves. So this is something that we see very often. And again, they weren't, I hate to say it, the kids weren't bad kids. But they had this idea, they had this crazy notion that, well, we can tap into mom's credit because when she dies, she's not going to need it. So we're only sticking it to the banks, really. And they'll forgive the debt when she's dead. And mom was saying, Exactly. They're claiming their inheritance early, except it's not her money, it's the bank's money. And mom was saying, no, when I go out of this world, I want to go out with a clean record and a clean reputation and honest kids. And so, of course, the problem then is, well, then mom doesn't want to prosecute the kids. So we have all this information, we have all this evidence, we've got all this documentation, we've got this victim, and there's nothing we can do about it. Yeah, I know, well, maybe you don't like your kids as much as she did, and which is perfectly fair. You know, my mom only likes half her kids anyway. I won't say which half I fall into. Yeah, exactly. At the back. Sure. Well, think about everyone else who has access to Social Security number. Your doctor has. Your dentist has. You'll get it. I think is it still on your Medicare card? Your Social Security number. And that's not including all the thousands of criminals out there who already have it. Exactly, who know nothing about security and who've never been through a background check. I mean, that's my biggest fear, is walking into my doctor. And you've ever noticed in a doctor's office, it's almost a gallery for rogues, because you'll see behind the reception area rows and rows of files. Now, every single one of those files is a patient, living, dead, previous, or current. And every one of those patient files has a social security number, a spouse's name, an address, a phone number, social security number. And when I go to my doctor's office, the first thing I notice is barely has a lock on the door to his office, and there's no security alarm on it. So, I mean, you just take one doctor's office, and they could have thousands of these files, and that's why it's such a massive, insidious crime. Another problem, again, I don't want to scare you. What I want to do is make you aware so that your radar is a little bit more tuned. There's a little bit of good news, actually, that I'll go through later. But another big problem is caregivers. Again, because of the economy, because of social services, you know, they're lowering the bar for caregivers. They're not putting them through the background checks, that kind of thing. So caregivers can do the same thing, and they can either be simply dishonest, or they can be... if you can afford it, that's a fantastic thing to do. And again, you're hitting the point on the head. Take responsibility for your own information and your own protection, and don't rely on others to do it. But the problem with caregivers, you know, caregivers are not like a pair of socks. You can't change them as often as you like. You know, you're given the caregiver by social services, and you've got to deal with that person. And quite often you create a bond with that caregiver. You know who they are. They know who you are. You may not be inclined to turn that person in so much, particularly, you know, for the very elderly who maybe it's the only friendship or relationship that they have. And of course, there are all kinds of scams that will come through your phone or right up to your door. I'm sure a lot of you heard of the scams where someone comes to the front door saying they're from the water department or PG&E. Exactly, and then their friend is crawling through the back window. Well, they're not after your jewelry. I mean, I've heard it so many times. Well, they can come in. I don't have any jewelry. They don't want your jewelry. They'd like any correspondence that has your name or social security number on it. So a simple thing that you can do, for example, is go through your house and do what I call a paper audit. Pick up every piece of paper that has any personal information about you, even something that has your name and address, and hide it. The greatest enemy of burglars is time. They don't like to spend much time in your home. They want to get in and get out fast. So if you take all that personal information... Don't buy a shredder. Don't buy a safe. Stick it under a rug. When was the last time a burglar looked under a rug for anything? So, you know, so you can see how simple it is. So, for example, one of the most common ways identity thieves get your information is through burglary. How easy it is to defeat them. Get that information and hide it. Put behind a bookshelf. Put it under a cushion. They don't want to spend a lot of time in your house digging around for this information. Another thing that you can do, actually... I've known some people to do is give them misinformation. There's this idea that if a burglar doesn't find the information he wants, he will keep looking and keep looking. It's like he's determined that there's money in there. He's going to find it someplace. Put some information out there that's of no use to you, but he doesn't know it. So put something, old correspondence from the IRS, but chop the top off so that your social security number is not there, or from social services. So leave a pile of information, because he'll see that, he'll take a quick look at it, he'll say, this looks like it's valuable, he'll grab it and go. It's only by the time he gets around the corner, he gets home, he realizes that it's of no value. Little tricks like that can really protect you. Another common trick, obviously, is the phone call. And what we're seeing a lot is people calling up and saying, listen, we're from such and such a bank or an organization, and we think you've been a victim of fraud, and we want to sign you up for these free credit monitoring services. And they probably won't call you again. And you're absolutely right. I mean, another great defense against identity theft is to be rude. If they're genuine, they don't need to be asking you for sensitive information. If it's your bank, if it's your credit card company, if it's PG&E, they don't need to be asking you for your social security number. They'll already have it. If they need it, they have it. All they'll need maybe is the easiest thing to do is when they call up and say, well, can you tell us, you know, who your name, what your name is, your phone number, your address, so we can verify you. Tell them, no, you tell me and I'll tell you if you're right. And that's the easiest way to protect yourself. So as I say, we've got these scams going on all the time. They come from every kind of angle. They're really after your information. They're particularly after your social security number. So if you can keep that information hidden, you're going to be very well protected. Another thing, another way they get their hands on the information is by stealing your mail. Now, mail theft has become a profession in itself. It's amazing. Identity theft has become so sophisticated, there are hierarchies, there are groups. One of the lowest hierarchies, one of the lowest groups are the mail thieves. And all they do is drive around neighborhoods waiting for the mailman to drop off the mail and they'll snatch the mail. Almost every time now, when we work with local police departments, wherever they are investigating burglary suspects, drug suspects, identity theft suspects, 9 times out of 10, either the vehicle or the home is packed with mail. Because they'll either steal this mail or they'll buy this mail, knowing that if they can't use the information, they'll sell it to someone else. So how do you defeat that? You get your mail in as soon as you can, and again, you hide it. If you're not ready to read it, hide it under, you know, stick it in a vase, stick it in the cupboard, stick it somewhere where they can't find it, but get it as soon as possible so they don't have a chance. A question at the back? Right.
But you have to open it with a key.
Right. So, it's not... It's not an ideal situation. If you can get your mail delivered into your home, that's great. But we know the mail service doesn't really do that anymore. This is another reason why I hate to boast that Europeans are better, but sometimes we do things better. But we don't have mail delivered to our curbside. Our mail comes into our front door through a letterbox, which is why identity theft is far less of a problem over there. A question at the front? Right. Right.
And, you know, who do you trust? What do you suggest? You can't even trust your own family. And I can imagine that's true in some cases.
Yeah, that is a challenge. I mean, if you're visually challenged and you can't look around your home and see, well, what's where and what's where it's not supposed to be, you have to be just try and be a little bit more vigilant. Well, where do you normally put your information? I mean, if you're like me, my information is all over the house. I'll pick something up, I'll read it, and I'll put it down wherever. I mean, I'm a gold mine for identities because I don't practice what I preach.
But you know, if you're sight impaired,
right.
You can't do that.
Exactly.
You put everything right back in exactly the same place, but you never find it again.
Right.
And so, you know, people know, and you have to be really structured.
Right.
Right.
Well, what about a simple trick like this, that from now on, your filing cabinet is under one cushion on one sofa?
Well, it's too tall.
You're making this very hard for me. There's got to be some place. There's got to be a rug. There's got to be something. And so essentially, when you get the mail, if you're not ready to read it, put it under a cushion. When you're finished reading it, put it under a cushion. Because then if a thief comes in, they can't see it lying around the place, and you don't have to worry. Well, I'm an identity theft expert, not a magician. I wish I had the answer to that. That is part of the problem, that... That's right, and even when you're full sighted, it doesn't make any difference. You still don't know if you can trust them. That's, yeah. True. Well, maybe we'll have to work with Bernice and figure that one out. That'll be your challenge for next year. A question at the back?
Earlier, you suggested that banks, some banks, claim not to be responsible for withdrawals
Sure. This is something that we get again and again. There are laws in place. There's a thing, one of them, for example, is the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. And that basically tells the bank that if money is taken from your account, by whatever means, by taken fraudulently, you're only liable for the first $50 if you report that within 2 days of discovering it. It doesn't mean 2 days of your statement. If you report it within 2 days of discovering it, you're only liable for $50, and most banks will waive that. And if you report it within 60 days, you're liable for the first $500. But I think most people, as soon as they discover that there's money missing from their account, will contact the bank. If the consumer, the victim, is not aware of that law, quite often the banks will say, it's not our responsibility. And they have a number of tricks. For example, a lot of the scams we're seeing these days are called skimming scams. And a skimming scam is, I don't know if you heard of Lucky Supermarkets last year, where thieves got into the supermarket some way. In 24 different supermarkets, they replaced just one of the self-checkout card readers. So everyone who used their debit card at that reader, the thieves were able to copy the bank account information and the PIN number. And then created new cards and started emptying those bank accounts. Now, what the bank said, well, hang on a second. If you didn't lose your card and someone used the card information and the PIN number, it had to be you. And we were knocked back. We said, well, hang on a second. Have you never heard of skimming? There are tricks out there where people can steal your PIN. They can steal your card information. Even if you never actually lose the card. But what the banks are relying on is the fact that a lot of consumers don't know that that doesn't matter. The law is the law. It's quite simply that if you report within 48 hours, you're only liable for $50. So now we have to go and take on the banks. We have to fight. Wells Fargo is notorious for this, and we have to fight them tooth and nail and remind them of the law. I'll give you another example. And again, it kind of, you know, it puts together a lot of the different stories we're talking about here today. A 75-year-old victim who lives on Geary Street got a set of Mercedes registration plates in the mail. And she thinks, well, I know I didn't order a Mercedes. You know, who knows who did? Turns out it was her niece had stolen her identity and gone down and bought one of these smart cars from the Mercedes dealership. So she went down, she marched down, she was just around the corner and said, this isn't me. The salesperson said, well, the niece said she had power of attorney, and the victim said, well, show me the documentation. And the salesperson went off on this, you know, fake legal rant. We don't have to show you any documentation. We don't have to show you any information. We believe it was done in good faith, and you take it up with your niece. So we called the sales director of the dealership. We got the same thing from him. He says, we want to see a warrant. We want to see an adjudication from a judge. I reminded him of the law. I said, listen, this is the law. This is the section. Go talk to your lawyers. Go look it up. And if we don't have a response in 24 hours, we'll take it to the media. We got a response. But you've got, it's one of the terrible characteristics, if you like, of identity theft, is that victims are victimized repeatedly. So you lose your identity, which is bad enough. Then you go to the police department and they say, well, there's nothing we can do for you. So you feed her on your own again. And then when you're fighting the debt collectors and the creditors and the people who can help fix it, they say, we don't be bothered with it. You need a search warrant or something like that. So victims are victimized again and again and again. So there was a perfect example. An elderly victim, visually impaired as well. So she was relying on her niece for all her documentation, to manage the documentation. The niece took advantage of her. The police weren't able to help her. The dealership wasn't able to help her. She was very clever, though. She said, my niece cannot drive that car legally without the plates, and the dealership cannot take the car back without the plates. So she hung on to the plates. And now everyone's angry at her. And I told her, you hang on to those plates because that's your protection. That's your evidence that someone did this. So that's as I say, just an example of the kind of scams that are going on around there that you have to be careful of. I mean, I can go on and on. There are so many different scams, but I think I've probably given you enough to worry about for the day. Question at the front?
I've often wondered what happens to my credit card when I give it to the waitress.
Well, she might buy herself a nice pair of shoes, or she might give herself an extra generous tip. Well, that's the thing, and I wish I'd brought one with me, but we talked about skimming before. Skimming is this thing, for example, it happened at Lucky's where they replace the reader and you swipe the card and it copies it. Another type of skimming is at ATM machines when you put your card in to take out money. They've replaced the reader with their own reader and they have a little camera installed above the ATM to get your PIN number. Well, another type of skimmer is what's called a handheld skimmer, and it is about the size of a cassette tape. And what and it's very common at restaurants. So you give the waiter your card. The waiter takes the card back to run it. Before he gets to the register, he runs it, takes out this little handheld skimmer, and he runs a copy of it. And then he can literally has a copy of your credit card. We have individual waiters are exploiting that, but we have organized crime gangs who plant waiters at restaurants just to do this. So this is something you have to be particularly careful of. There's a question at the front first and a question at the back, and I'll explain skimmers in there. Right.
And so I'm concerned about that, that the IRS would require that,
and that, I have some really bad news for you. The IRS is very stupid. The IRS is an incredibly stupid organization, and yes, they will ask for you to put your Social Security number on your check. So if the check goes missing in there, some department, they can tie it back to the original individual. You don't think they have a better way to do that? IRS tax fraud is huge. I was talking to a police officer the other day who talked to the Franchise Tax Board a couple of weeks ago, who said, so far this year, identity thieves have stolen about $500 million worth of tax refunds in California in the first 2 weeks of this year. It's a massive fraud. And I always advise, get your tax returns in early because, talking about the stupidity of the IRS, and I hope there isn't an IRS agent here because I may be in real trouble when I walk through those doors. All they require to submit a refund is your name and your Social Security number. They don't check that you're living at the same address. So, for example, you've lived at the same address for 30 years, and suddenly they get a new tax return that's from Florida. You've had five children on your tax returns for years. Another person in Florida has none, or you have none, and the person in Florida has 20. You've been retired for 10 years, and the person in Florida is working. They don't cross-check all the other information. They take it on face value that if you submit just your name and your Social Security number, you're good to go. And they don't audit tax refunds of less than $10,000. So you have all these thieves running through multiple refunds of $9,000 or $9,900, and the IRS is just giving them this money. Going back for a second to credit cards and debit cards, my advice is never, ever, ever use a debit card for anything other than taking money out of an ATM. The thing is, if you have a debit card, that's your money. When you use a debit card, the money's coming out of your bank account. If you're using a credit card, it's the bank's money. I'm okay with the bank losing money. They're very good at that. And because I mentioned earlier, the banks will always say, well, don't worry about your debit card. We'll put the money back in your account. They can take their time doing it. I mean, the law allows them up to 3 months to investigate before you get your money back. If you've got important bills to pay, you've got rent to pay, you've got drugs to buy, you know, you can't wait for that long. So what I would suggest is getting a credit card, getting a low balance credit card, pay it off at the end of the month, and use it for everything. Sorry, a question at the front, and then I'll go to the back. Yes, Global Payments. It was pretty large. Yeah. This is, the question we often get asked is, well, where do they get all this information? There's a thing called a data breach. Data breaches are attacks usually by hackers who break into companies that have all your personal information. It could be a store card, it could be a credit card company, it could be the IRS, it could be the Social Security Administration. Let me give you another statistic that might keep you awake at night. Last year in the United States, there were 360 million personal records were exposed in data breaches. So that's more than every person living in America. 80% of those included Social Security numbers. So that's mainly how they're getting your personal information. So that tells you, you have to assume your information is already out there. What you've got to do is focusing on minimizing the chance that they'll use it against you and having that radar up so you detect it. A question at the back? Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'll answer that first, then we'll get your other question. Yeah, again, just because it makes sense doesn't mean they necessarily do it. I'll give you an example. Again, us fancy Europeans and why we're so less vulnerable to identity theft than Americans. Years and years ago, the American banking system moved away from the credit cards that America uses. Credit cards in America have a magnetic stripe on it. It means there's no protection. Anyone can copy it. Years ago, European banks moved to what's called a smart card or a chip card, which is like a computer on your card. If you don't have the right code, you can't use that information. The American banks have said, well, we don't want to do that because we're such a huge country, we can't afford it. Every single card reader in every restaurant, every ATM would have to be changed. Now, finally, the frauds are so big, they're finally saying, okay, well, maybe we'll do it now. It's exactly the same with the handheld readers. You still got a situation in the United States where you give your card to a complete stranger and they disappear into a back room. If that's not the formula for crime, I don't know what is. In a lot of restaurants in Europe, they come up. It's just like In-N-Out burgers, a lot of burger joints. You don't have to go into the burger joint anymore. They will come out and they will take your order with a little handheld device. They haven't quite got as far as taking your credit card, but they'll get there eventually. So what was your second question? Very good question. The credit report really is the key to protecting yourself against identity theft, because not all identity theft is looking for money, but most of it is. And most of the times, they're looking to open up new credit accounts in your name, and that will come up on your credit report. There are credit reports that are called soft and hard inquiries. A hard inquiry is when someone applies for credit in your name. That's a sign that someone is stealing your identity, and it can also work against your credit score. A soft inquiry is you checking your own credit report. That has no impact whatsoever on your credit. So you can check your credit report every single month, every single day if you like. Financial institutions actually think that's a better thing rather than a bad one, because it shows that you are watching out, that you're financially and fiscally responsible. What I would suggest when it comes to credit reports, if you don't take a lot... Sorry?
We have some more information about that.
Oh, perfect. I can give Bernice a list of the things that I've talked about afterwards, the resources, the places that you can go. But the best thing you can do to protect your identity from people taking out new credit in your name, which is what 9 out of 10 thieves want to do, is to freeze your credit reports. Now, the credit bureaus fought this tooth and nail. It's a federal law. Every state now has it. You can freeze your credit reports, which means you call up each of the three bureaus. You have to pay them $10 per bureau. That's the only downside.
Our attorneys have negotiated that one free credit report in large print or braille per year.
Okay, great. But that's a credit report. That's not placing a credit freeze. And
the freeze is $10?
Yeah, the freeze is $10. If you're over the age of 65, it's $5 per report. If you're a victim of identity theft, it's free. And essentially what happens, you contact the bureau, you can do it in writing, you can do it by mail, or you can do it by online. They will lock your credit report. They will give you a PIN number. It's like a code. It's a long PIN number. No one will ever be able to take out credit using your identity ever again without that PIN number. And it's a long PIN number. I mean, some of them are 20 digits. So you've got to keep a copy of that, keep it nice and safe, give it to someone you know and trust, put it in the bank, hide it somewhere in the house. If you lose it, it's not the end of the world. They can still go through a process to get your report again. But it means that if someone tries to apply for new credit in your name, no matter what information they have on you, your credit is locked for life. Yeah, let's say in 6 months' time, you decide, well, you know, I want to buy that Cadillac after all. So you go to the Cadillac dealership and you say, okay, how long do you need to check my credit report? And they'll say a week. You can unlock your credit report just for a week. You don't have to unlock all three. You can. Most creditors, most credit card companies, if you're applying for a credit card, most stores, if you're applying for a store card, they only check one bureau because all three bureaus are supposed to have the same information. So you ask them, well, which bureau do you run a credit check through? And if they say Experian, you just call Experian that. They say, okay, you can do two things. You could say, I want to unlock it for a period of time, like a week, or I want to unlock it just for, you know, Cadillac of Menlo Park. So they will only allow that company or anybody for that period of time to run a credit check on you, and then the freeze is replaced afterwards. Thieves absolutely hate that because they go to all this trouble of either stealing or buying your information. They realize you've got great credit, they've got lots of information on you, and they can't get any credit out in your name. The credit bureaus hate it too because, I hate to be cynical, but I am, but credit bureaus make money from